Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for coming tonight, and it gives me very great pleasure to welcome you to this talk by Deepa Narayan. I'm Jo Beale, I'm Director of the Development Studies Institute at the LSE, and I welcome you both on behalf of myself and Destin and Dr. Tony Hall and the Social Policy and Development Cluster in the Social Policy Department. We are co-hosting this event. And are both delighted to have with us today Dr. Deepa Narayan, who is a senior advisor in the Poverty Reduction and Economic Management Network of the World Bank. Deepa has a long history not only in the World Bank, where she has played a very, very important role in putting issues of poverty, empowerment, and participation on the agenda, and in getting economists and econometricians to take these ideas seriously and to engage with them in a professional way. She has paved a way for those of us in working on social development, for which her legacy will be very important and for which we are very grateful. Deepa has worked on participation in Africa. She has co-edited and organized the two books, Voices of the Poor, which made a huge impact on the World Bank, and in which one of them she collaborated with Robert Chambers, in whose work I know some of you are very interested. She has 25 years of development experience in both Africa and Asia, and she is currently undertaking a 10 to 15 country study entitled Moving Out of Poverty, Understanding Freedom, Democracy and Growth from the Bottom Up. And it's coming out of this agenda, as well as her previous experience and insights and work, that she's going to talk to us tonight. So Deepa, thank you very much for giving up your time to address us at LSE and to talk to this research agenda.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Is this on?
Yeah,
okay. I'm very impressed that you're here this evening at 7 p.m. on a cold light. You have copies of my slide. And I wanted to start with a couple of questions. In the UK, after the Glen Eagles meeting and with the concerts, etc., and the pledges that the government has made, it's very clear that poverty is on not only government agenda, but also, at least from the perceptions from the outside, that it is on people's minds in a new way, which raises the issue of who cares the most about poverty reduction. Any ideas, reactions? Who cares the most about reducing poverty? There are lots of people in the world working on poverty reduction. There are lots of types of people, there are lots of organizations, including the World Bank, NGOs, Oxfam. There are lots of concerned citizens about poverty reduction. So who cares the most about reducing poverty? The poor. The poor. You're bright, you're smart. That's exactly right. So one of my professional life stories or ambitions in life has been that realization, because I grew up not in a very privileged, but I grew up in a middle class family in India. And when my first time of living in a rural area with poor people was in a village in Botswana. And I think my intellectual journey actually started there, unlearning many things that I'd learned in school, but really putting the research, the discipline of an anthropologist to work, which is really trying to understand taking the assumption very seriously that people are rational, and trying to understand in very different cultural, political, economic contexts, again, a very simple question, which is, why do people do what they do? And the intellectual journey or the professional journey has been really putting assumptions aside over and over again and trying to understand whether it was in designing toilets or rural water supply or programs that were meant to empower women in rural areas, whether it was in Indonesia or Maldives Islands, over and over again putting our assumptions aside and are trying to understand from the bottom up, why do people do what they do? Because if you ask that very simple question and bring your research skills to bear on that, then I can guarantee you, you will never be bored in life. And whatever discipline you come from or whatever issues you decide to handle, you'll have answers that fit the issue much better than any standard answers you've been taught or you've heard. So I joined the World Bank in 1991, and have been there since. I started working with engineers for about 15 years, and then the last 10 years has been an economist, and I'm neither an engineer or an economist. So it's been quite a challenge, and again, I think, if I've had any impact, it's been, again, bringing the same discipline of thinking systematically on why do economists say what they say, or why do engineers say what they say in terms of design, etc., and learning the language, their language, and their research paradigm, and fitting into that to then address the same issues, the same questions that they're interested in, but bringing the strengths of my discipline to bear. So one I've already spoken about is that the people who are the most motivated about poverty reduction to move out of poverty are poor people themselves. But how do you bring the simple concept, or the simple fact to bear in terms of design of both programs and policies? The second is that the world is very unequal. Whether you go to a village or an urban area in India or Pakistan or in Africa or in China or in the Philippines or in the US or probably here as well, I'm sure here as well, that the world is very unequal. So opportunities are unequally distributed. So if you live in an unequal world and poor people live in an unequal world and they don't cause poverty, how can they overcome poverty? And one of the themes, if I look back, that's come through both in my learning across working across different sectors, whether it's in the water supply or health or education, has been the theme of collective action. So I'm going to be talking a lot about that, that individually poor people cannot overcome obstacles, because the whole system, the institutions are stacked up against them. But collectively, combined with other things, they have a greater chance. So let me move to the... So today what I want to talk about... Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay, so today what I want to talk about is economic empowerment. The first point I want to make is about ideology and raise the issue of has civil society failed the poor. Just as we, there are two issues that I think keep coming in the way of moving forward collectively. First one is in terms of ideology and two kinds of ideological traps. One I've already alluded to, which is the debate between are NGOs or is the private sector or is the government, who is better positioned, who is better located both ideologically and in terms of substance, who are better implementers. And I think the ideological debate itself has come in the way of collaboration between among the actors and learning across these different organizations. The second sort of ideological trap is disciplinary. So economists talk about economic growth. Anthropologists and the other non-economic social scientists talk about livelihoods. But it is when you aggregate the livelihoods of millions of poor people, it leads to or contributes to economic growth. What has been missing is the knowledge of the details of the livelihoods of poor people aggregated together in a way that makes sense at the policy level, and aggregated in a way that divides, that bridges the divide between the language of the economists on one hand, who generally work at the macro level or the national level, and the detailed ethnographic sociological knowledge that you see at the micro level. So one of the challenges in development studies and in social policy is how do you bring to bear micro realities, but present them in a way, or look at them, or analyze them in ways that make sense or that's relevant to policy, whether it's social policy or economic policy. So what I want to do today is talk about four programs that I have been looking at recently. This issue of economic empowerment actually emerged very strongly from the work that Joe Beal talked about earlier in terms of voices of the poor. And if you look at where there has been poverty reduction, large poverty reduction, there are very few instances where you can say that civil society played a major role. This is not to say that civil society is not important or did not do things to create space, but by and large, you cannot conclude that civil society led to poor people's economic well-being in large numbers. So what I want to talk about is poor people, both their producers, consumers, and citizens. How the role of the middle class, as well as three actors, civil society, government, and the private sector. And basically, it is when poor people try to move up, it's when does the middle class become really large so that the mobility upwards remains stable and sure, so that the shocks that come invariably don't move them, push them back into poverty. There are many conceptual frameworks. Let me. So that's the. I'd forgotten about that. Okay. This conceptual framework emerged after a couple of years of analysis looking at. When I was trying to answer the question for the World Bank on what is empowerment. Those of you who are familiar with the World Development Reports, that every 10 years we do a major one on poverty. And the one that we did in 2000 became very, very controversial because it introduced three themes: opportunity, security, and what? Does anybody know? Empowerment. So empowerment became very controversial, and at the end of that report, I was asked basically to look at that issue of empowerment and to develop it in a way that made sense to within the context of the World Bank. So this framework builds on that work and actually takes it further. Basically, we're talking about empowerment as the interaction or the outcome of interaction between two broad things. The first is the opportunity structure, and we're talking about for this presentation, looking at economic opportunity, and on the other hand is agency of the poor. And it's the interaction between these two that leads to all kinds of development outcomes, including incomes of the poor, or looking at inequality, or democratic performance, etc. So on the right-hand side, agency of the poor, the individual assets and capabilities are probably familiar to you. You know, their range of from material to human capital, education kinds of things, social relations, we put a lot of emphasis on this, political participation, as well as psychological assets and capabilities. What do we mean by that? Issues of self-esteem, issues of self-confidence. If a person doesn't believe in themselves, they're unlikely to take a chance or to take action. But these are all individual at the individual level. Basically, I think what the sociological literature shows that individual assets and capabilities are not enough. If you look at the econometric work or the work that economists do, the emphasis is primarily on this box, which is very helpful, which provides some explanation, but it's only partial. What's missing? What's missing is that if you look at people only as individuals, you get a partial picture, and you don't get into the issues of social stratification and inequality. Because societies are stratified by social group. Economists look at individuals, but nobody in this world lives as atomized individuals. They belong to a social group. It could be on the base of kin, it could be on the basis of work relations, it could be on the base of politics, any of these factors, but basically we're social creatures. We belong to we have a particular identity. There may be multiple identities depending upon the context, but this social stratification becomes very important. Now, because poor people have the least power, then for them particularly, individual attributes aren't sufficient to get them out of poverty. And so we put a lot of emphasis on the collective assets and capabilities. This includes voice, organization, representation, as well as issues of identity. The individual assets and capabilities and the collective assets, there's obviously an interaction between the two, because if you're organized, you may be able to manage a school better and get your kids into school. But if you have someone with high education, they may be able to help you organize, mobilize, or connect to local government resources. On the left-hand side is the opportunity structure and the two boxes. The first one on institutional climate. Now, assume for a minute this could be applied to local government. It could be applied to the private sector. It could be applied to national government. It could be applied to civil society. But the institutional climate that governs local government is going to determine the interaction, the nature of interaction between poor people and that organization. But it's the informal and the formal rules and the norms and the resources that flow between these two that govern the quality of that interaction as well as the outcome. So if you take an example, if you think about local government and the first one, which is information, you may have formal rules about the Freedom of Information Act, but if in fact the local government officials behave in ways which makes it very difficult to get the information out, it's not going to be possible, which is what's happening in many states in India. The other two elements are mechanisms or rules about inclusion, participation, accountability, and capacity to organize. And these vary depending upon the social and political structures, how open they are, how closed, etc. I've spent a bit of time on this because you're students, and it's important to see the framing of the concepts. So let me move now to the four programs that we looked at, that I looked at. First is SEWA. How many of you have heard about SEWA in India? It's probably one of the world's best known programs. It deals with poor women who are self-employed. They may be vendors, they may be traders of different sorts. They work in the informal economy, and they've organized in different ways. The current numbers are about 700,000 women. The second one that you probably don't know about, that's become even larger in a much shorter time, is the self-help group movement in Andhra Pradesh. And in the last few years, they've already reached $475 million, equivalent of $475 million that they received from banks in terms of credit. The third one is Amul, which is the world's, actually, as I understand, the world's largest dairy cooperative. And it, in just in India, it reaches over 12 million dairy farmers. And the numbers are mind-boggling, at least to me still. About $20 billion worth of milk every year. The fourth is eChopals. You probably haven't heard about this. This is more recent, and it's run by a private sector. The private sector, which connects about 3 million farmers, it's been in operation less than 5 years. The first 2 years were pilots, and it's spreading like wildfire. By the year, by 2010, they expect to have a revenue of $2.5 billion. Okay. You all have heard about and probably worked with lots of small programs. The reason I'm focusing on this is to make a point that if we want to impact the lives of millions of poor people, then small efforts have to achieve scale and become big. If they don't become big, it's great to make the difference in a few people's lives, but given the scale of the problem, it's not going to add up and move from the micro to show up in the numbers in terms of growth. So the questions we asked is, you know, why? What is similar and different in these programs, and why are they working? And the one very clear thing is that it's not just civil society. A good implementer can be from the government. The self-help groups is a program run by the government of Andhra Pradesh. Seva is civil society. Amul is civil society, but with very close financing and collaboration with the government of India. In fact, the government of India set up huge autonomous institutions. And eChopals, there are no subsidies. It's implemented completely by the private sector. It has nothing to do with the government, with no changes in policy, rules, or regulations, and has achieved this impact within 3 years. Okay. So what have we learned in this? The first one is that there has been a tremendous both market failure, government failure, and civil society failure in investing in collective agency, which means the organizations of poor people. In Seva, as you've seen, there are cooperatives, and this has evolved over 35 years. In the self-help groups, the numbers are just huge, but what they've done additionally is that they've federated upwards. In Amul, it's 12 million farmers. Again, farmer-controlled cooperatives over 35 years. eChopal is interesting because they make no attempt to create any new organizations of poor people or farmers, but the computer is the aggregator of demand. And I'll get back to that in a minute. The other key finding is that in all these programs, except the ones that are specifically targeted on women, which are the first two, the Seva and self-help groups, women are excluded because it's very difficult to change social structures. And unless you have special efforts to address the barriers that women face, you're not going to see a difference. Amul actually, over a period of time, then started women's cooperatives. And the numbers have gone up some to about 20 million of the farmers of the 12. It's about 20%, but that change came over a period of 20 years. eChopal doesn't have any statistics on whether it's men or women, but they're reaching poor farmers, but only about 10%. The second seems very simple, but if you think about economic opportunity and growth, that economic opportunities, it depends on who's able to take advantage of them. These four programs, in different ways, were able to link poor people to economic opportunities that were relevant to their life, to their skills, to their education, without having to wait, say, 5 years or 10 years and say that you now need training in computers or you now need training in this and that before you can access economic opportunities. So if you think of SEWA, they have an integrated approach. They do all kinds of things from providing health insurance, etc. But their basic purpose was starting with where women were at. So they worked with head loaders. Is there a lot of disturbing sound? Okay. So they work with, in urban areas, they work with women who are carrying vegetables on their head. And so it's a civil society program that links directly to what women were doing, from salt production in very marginal salt production areas to gum production in forested areas. Now, if you think about the self-help groups, again, it was linked directly to women's lives, and they used an integrated approach, and they focus on agricultural products. What is different is the way they're achieving scale in improving the agri-procurement chain in about 10 to 15 commodities. Amul is again linked to what poor people are already doing. 90 million cattle in India, of which 70 million households own 90 million of the cattle. And most of these own one or two cattle. So they didn't exclude large cattle holders. So the middle class is included, but it's primarily poor people. E-Chopal, on the other hand, really aimed at the middle class, at the middle farmer. And this was first started in the area where they were producing soya beans. And there was a lot of corruption and a lot of restrictions in whom you had to sell to the government officials. And they basically changed that completely by setting up a computer in the home of a farmer and total transparency and information. So they said, these are the prices today. This is what you will get if you sell to us, but you are not obliged to sell to us. And so that transparency of information of prices and the fairness in weighing the products, because poor people or farmers were getting cheated by how if it's the maize, how it was being weighed, etc. That shifted completely power relations. And over a period of time, it just took off because people started trusting this particular company. Although it reaches median farmers, small farmers are not excluded. So now what they need to do is refine this approach to ensure that both poor people and women are reached. The third major finding is that poor people are poor because they buy in small quantities and they sell in small quantities. And it's that basic disadvantage that has to be overcome. And the moment you start aggregating, their power relations start shifting because the big players come into play and they want to interact with poor people. In all these examples, what shifted is the fairness of the middlemen. And as they aggregated, you'll see that power relations change completely. SEWA has been the least successful because they work on over 70 occupations, so their effort has gotten diffused, although they're making changes now and beginning to link up with private sector. Self-help groups have just had an astounding growth. They have federated into not just local level at the village level, but then also at the district level and now the state level. And unlike SEWA, they have the same organization. Everyone belongs to the same network, irrespective of what they're producing. So their efforts haven't gotten diffused. Amul, as you saw, has been only on one commodity, which has been milk. And so they've been very focused in the efforts. And E-Chopal's as well started with one commodity And then once they figure that out, they've diversified and gone on to address other agricultural products. You can have organization, but it doesn't necessarily translate into economic power. The economic power comes only if you start to aggregate, as I had said, the power of numbers of people engaged in a particular economic activity. And once you've done that, you move on to other activities. There are very few NGOs who've been able to achieve scale in here, because till very recently, civil society organizations were not business-oriented, were not interested in achieving scale. There's been very little thinking in terms of corporations for poor people, or venture capital for poor people, or looking at financial instruments beyond microcredit and thinking of what would these would need to look like if you want to serve poor people. Self-help groups have captured the maize market. They are capturing the neem market in southern India. And this is making the private sector sit up and take notice, who are now going to the self-help groups and trying to set up partnerships with them. The same thing with Amul. Amul is the single largest food company in India. And you know, everyone who's been to India or knows India grew up on these amazing ads on Amul, which have been very professionally done. And Ethiopals, again, to show the economic clout, because the system that was set up bypassed the traditional mandis, which are the traditional markets, the people in the markets who were losing out went on strike. And the farmers who were benefiting, once they took to the streets, the mandi middlemen had to back off, and then the strike was over, because the power of the farmers on the street make the politicians sit up, and will they pay attention to 25,000 farmers or to the handful of middlemen who are losing out from the new agri-chain, value chain. Now, once you have economic power, money talks. And this money talks, or economic power, changes into political clout. And the ability to change that, leverage that political clout to get rules and regulations that are fairer. And we see this happening. Again, we can discuss this. Seva has tremendous international repute and has done amazing work with women, has a complex relationship with government, but I would say it has more moral clout than political clout in terms of changes in regulations, etc., because it doesn't have the economic clout. Self-help groups have been implemented by the government, and because they manage their relationship so well, and because of the large numbers of women, 6 million women, chief ministers pay attention to what these women are doing and what they want. This is a double-edged sword, because recently the chief minister lowered interest rates, which is the surest way of killing off the whole financial sustainability of banks. And again, we can talk about that. Amul, Verghese Kurien, who has been the head of Amul, has had prime ministers, the year of prime ministers, and was untouchable by bureaucrats for years, and used that political clout to make sure that the cooperative movement, while it was in its infancy, would grow. He used that political clout to restructure food aid in the 70s and 80s, in the first creative use of food aid, so that the prices of milk price didn't plunge, but used it in a way that actually led to the growth of the milk industry. And Ethiopals, as I said, they're gaining their political clout just from the economic clout and the fact that the farmers take to the streets if anyone tries to intervene with the program. So in effect, what we're talking about is liberalization from below. It's just liberalization from above doesn't necessarily benefit poor people. It may be good for overall economic growth, but it may not change the opportunities poor people have to participate in economic growth. So what we want is, rather than people falling off once they try to go up, is really how more and more poor people move up and actually join the middle class. So it has to do with middle class formation. I'm going to see if anyone gets to the top. Okay. So, conclusions. In the bank and the world over, as I think is now cliche, is economic growth is important, clearly, but the investment climate needs to be disaggregated in terms of the large players and the very small players. And this needs to be linked back to their livelihoods and removing obstacles, including rules and regulations, that come in the way of the enterprises of poor people. The second is overall to improve state accountability to the poor. This is no longer fantasy, but there are many programs now where poor people are actually getting the resources and holding governments accountable. The third is aggregation. Without aggregation, you're not going to see the volumes and the numbers, and nobody is going to pay attention to poor people, either politically or economically. Fourth is that you have to invest in building organizations of the poor. This cannot be done overnight. There are lots of mistakes that have been made when you have large-scale programs that try to create organizations or create self-help groups mechanically, because it becomes what I would call form over function. You can create groups, but they're not going to function because they're not really representative. People don't understand what they're about, and there's elite takeover. And finally, an idea on corporate social responsibility. This has been talked about. There's lots of money being pouring in. And I think a lot of the private sector does what would be considered basic community development work, and a lot of it is done very poorly. So as part of self-interest, it could be very important to not only invest in, create poor people's organizations that take time to mature, but to also experiment with create financial instruments, both insurance products, venture capital, and other more creative ways of ensuring that poor people have access to economic opportunities, the same way that a middle class or someone at higher, both socioeconomic strata in society has. So that's it. I'll stop there. I think I've kept to my 45 minutes. And we'll take questions.
Do you want to take questions?
Sure.
Well, Deepa, thank you. Do feel free to come and sit for questions if you'd prefer. And we'd like to thank you for what you've said so far. I think that's been a real eye-opener for me to see how the work you're doing has progressed from the voices of the poor, and it's exciting to see the coming together of collective action, individual agency, institutions, and the economy. I think one of the things that I'd like to say from the outset and ask you while people are gathering their thoughts, to ask what you think is different about what you're finding and what you're studying compared to the cooperative movement of the 70s, because cooperatives were really strong and important in reducing poverty. They then fell deeply out of fashion. I think it's only really the Scandinavians, and particularly the Swedes, that have continued to promote cooperatives as a way of aggregating up and out. And yet what we're seeing and what you're talking about is a different configuration of stakeholders and interconnections, but quite similar recipes for growth and poverty reduction. So perhaps you wouldn't mind commenting on that.
Should I start with that?
And then I'll open it up.
Okay, great question. I think, I mean, there are still some cooperatives from the 70s that have been successful, apparently, in Nepal, and Amul actually started in the 70s. I think the key difference is who makes the decisions. Who has control and authority over decisions and the money? And I think in the 70s, the experience in India is that it is naive to think that in a socially stratified society, when inequality is deep, that creating a cooperative will automatically change all that. So what happens is that the social structure, the social stratification in a society gets replicated in a cooperative, and very quickly the resources get taken over. So where you have revolving fund societies, the funds don't revolve. Where you have cooperatives, especially when they're closely linked to the government and managed by the government, which happened actually in South Asia and in India, you have the same practices that happen elsewhere superimposed on the cooperative, and the cooperatives become a source of resources to be siphoned off. I mean, in the bank, what we're calling community-driven development, the basic principle there is to focus on processes, implementation mechanisms that really give people at the local level the authority to decide on how to use that money, but with lots of transparency so that there really are discussions around how to program that money, and there are checks and balances, and that when money is not properly used, there is immediate action. Because once, if the in the first case there's no action, then it becomes a signal for everything goes.
Okay, thank you. Can I have any questions from the floor?
Go ahead.
Sort of short-term versus long-term security.
I think your question can be interpreted in different ways. Let me interpret it in the way I take it. Two parts to your question. First is, isn't civil society broader than NGOs? Absolutely. I think civil society, but I would say that it's important to keep civil society separate from the state. I think in many societies, the boundaries are porous in terms of individuals, so you can have someone from the state, you know, be in the government and then move out of the government and be part of a university or an NGO or an association of different kind. And the same thing with civil society, members of civil society going into and joining governments, as has been happening in the Philippines, for example. It's very rapid movement in and out, circular movement. I think in terms of markets and security, there are two things. One is, for markets to function, to keep that separate from security, I think markets, as you open them up, become more volatile and unstable. So there are two things, really. One is, are markets functioning, are markets a level playing field? And I'm basically saying they're not. So first is access to pure markets. The second, I think, is in terms of provision of safety nets or security, social insurance of different types in a society. I think there the state has a very important role to provide that, but the reality is in that most poor developing countries, the state doesn't have the financial resources to provide that. So then you have a rationing process that comes, whether it may be rational or not. So I would argue that they're still separate, and it's not one or the other, but what fits best in society. So we just had a big social policy conference that Tony and both Jobil were there, in which we basically argued that the social ideas of social welfare or social regimes that worked in the West will not work in developing countries for lots of reasons, but two, for example. One is, just in terms of sheer numbers of poor people, if 50, 60, 70% of your society is poor, then the amount of money that a government has is very different than when your poverty levels are 20 or 15%. The second is that poor people are primarily in the informal economy. So even formal safety nets don't reach them. So even there, I would say what's important, the message is that you need new ways of providing social protection that fit and will reach poor people, and particularly when the numbers are so large and when they're not part of formal, they don't show up on anyone's employment roster. In fact, one of the most difficult challenges of SEWA, since most of you know SEWA, which was the first trade union of informal workers, was that it took them 3 years to register. Because when they went to register, they said, who's your employer? If you're a trade union, you've got to have an employer. Well, you're self-employed, then who are you unionizing against? So it became a very interesting issue to think about.
Over there.
Question. Actually, after we did Voices of the Poor, where we had work with or interviews with 60,000 poor people in 60 countries, there were two key ideas that emerged from that. One was, poor people said, don't give money to governments, give it to us, or ensure it comes down to us through our organizations. So this whole issue of collective action and community organizations, became very important. And then the second one was access to markets. And I started in 2000, actually, to start getting organizations, representatives of organizations of the poor from around the world together in Washington in meetings. And they were very suspicious because this was the World Bank. At the end of 3 years, we created the first non-profit company called Global Grassroots, Grassroots Trading Network for, it's called GetNet, Grassroots, Trading Network for Grassroots Entrepreneurs. Now, I think Prahlad's ideas are exactly along the same line. I think it's very important for the private sector to see poor people both as consumers as well as producers. So both for future consumers for their products, as well as producers whom, if they help a bit, they can improve their profits. I think there's a high risk in this venture, because unless there's a vigilant civil society and unless there are strong organizations of the poor, unless there's an ethical approach to it, what will happen, my fear is that what will happen is that poor people's organizations, where they exist, will become distribution networks without a fair return for poor people, for the products, etc., to get down to the local level. What is interesting in India, where there are both with Seva as well as with the self-help groups, ITC, which is the company, the eChopals, because in the eChopal, the thing that Prahlad doesn't emphasize, that eChopal now recognizes because we've had several meetings with them, is only 10% of the farmers that they reach are poor. They don't even have statistics at this point in time whether they reach any women. Okay. So now, they are, now that they've come up with an approach, they are now pairing up with Seva, for example, in sesame seed production and in procurement. And what ITC is doing is training the poor women to process and package the sesame seeds in a way that can be procured by ITC and then exported to the US, etc. Similarly, they're doing shrimp farming. Other companies such as Hindustan Lever and Godrej are getting involved in helping poor women to farm in ways, improve their farming and other techniques. So the maize production, maize procurement, for example, is very simple. Women are being trained, poor women, they're not 99% of them are not literate, are being trained how to judge the quality of maize that they procure, graded into three categories, and been given scales and a very simple electronic measure to measure water content. As a result of their activities, other middlemen who are going to the villagers are being forced to pay higher prices. So in aggregate, everyone, all the producers are benefiting irrespective of how much they produce. Now, this is happening in some areas because of the activities of the Velugu program that's actually supporting these self-help groups. I think if these were not there, there wouldn't be a way of innovating and showing the potential of poor women, so it's sort of that win-win. So I think it is possible, but it requires institutional innovation, it requires technological innovation, it requires management innovation. And because of the ideological divide that I was talking about in terms of civil societies here, businesses are there and the state is there, that you don't have that cross-learning. And I think the biggest challenge for civil society is how to be a civil society and be business-oriented so that you achieve financial sustainability over a large scale, because there's only so much money that you can have. So use the subsidy to experiment and develop organizations, but with an eye on how would this be profitable. How can organizations of the poor be profitable and become corporations? So in India, for example, these self-help groups the older ones that have federated at the district level, the programs are now asking them to achieve financial sustainability, so that in 3 years the government will no longer be subsidizing them. So that how can they generate income streams so that they don't have to continuously depend on subsidies?
Thank you. I've got. I'm going to take a round of questions now because I think we need to finish at 8:15 at the latest. So I'll take a round if you don't mind, Deepa. And then, so there's two up here. So first you. And a question over there.
My question was related to, for me, the noticeable absence of culture within the conceptual framework for empowerment, then the translation of economic power to political, I'm not sure that it's clear as.
Okay, and there are two down here. Do you have a question? That's okay, fine. There's one there.
Is there opposition? Where does opposition
come from?
Is there opposition to?
To what?
And one at the back. Tell me if you want to stop.
No, that's okay. Does everyone know what CDD is? Okay. And last question in this round, and we'll see if we've got time for another. That's quite a lot to go on with. This is the fun part, though. why change in the cooperative structures? Why the change now? Why is it happening now? By the way, all good questions. I mean, in India. In India, what's happened is, I think it's the failure of poverty reduction. And leaders in civil society thinking more deeply in terms of what's missing or lacking in government state policies and in a private sector approach. I mean, it's good to have unleashed the private sector, there's economic growth, but is that all that's needed to lift people out of poverty? And given that in the 80s and early 90s, there had been poverty reduction, but there were still over 400 million poor people, the question is, what else do you need? So it was based on pulling together ideas from fairly large-scale programs in South Asia that worked, and then trying to design some pilots that overcame the earlier problems, and that's what led to the self-help group movement. So it's basically, how do you empower poor people in very difficult situations, and does it lead to any good? I think in terms of the economic versus social, and this comes back to the question on CDD as well, is one of the other things that's clear, and the turnaround in the self-help groups also, is that they all start addressing what poor people consider their immediate needs. Okay. It's only after a while that all of them, including Seva, started questioning that, yes, there has been some movement out of poverty, but people are still so vulnerable that the first shock that comes along and all your assets get wiped out. So it's that then has led to the focus on, you've got to focus on generating income streams that are sustainable over long run. So it's not that all people suddenly start producing mangoes or becoming tailors, because very quickly you run out of how many clothes, you know, the village is going to buy. So then people have started thinking about linkages, more systematic linkages to larger markets, so that the saturation is not reached immediately. And the second thing that's really important that I haven't emphasized is moving up the value chain. Because the higher you move up the value chain, the greater the returns. It's the producer of the raw materials that gets the least in return. But when you start processing and packaging it, then you get greater returns, which is why Amul, in terms of a cooperative, captured the entire value chain, from procuring the raw product, the milk, from processing it, pasteurizing, and to marketing it. And that's what led to the enormous profits that they have. So in terms of CDD, or community-driven development, the first generation have been on infrastructure, you're absolutely right. And it's only now that they're moving on to economic empowerment, and the self-help groups is the first most dramatic example of that. The reason also it's taken me 3 years to even get the ideas accepted in the bank is because there's such tremendous resistance. It comes back to mindsets. The idea that poor people have the capacity to think through and act in ways that will lead them to make rational decisions in business or in economics is beyond the ken of most people. So it's a leap of faith. We had 15 senior managers, including the country directors and the vice president, and many other senior people from the bank going out to villages in Andhra Pradesh. Before they went out, they were very, very skeptical. And when they went out and actually saw what was happening in village after village, and women who are still to this day illiterate, they cannot read or write. But you ask them about, you know, what money they're making, how they're making, and what the vision is for the future, it's just mind-boggling. So it's a mindset shift that sees poor people as successful entrepreneurs and producers, I think. That's taken a long time, and there's still a lot of skepticism, but hopefully that will be overcome. There is lots of resistance. That's a very important question. In each of these programs, what's interesting, has approached this problem differently. I think the ones that have been the most successful are those that don't start with a confrontational approach. And this is really, really important. In India, society is very stratified. So these programs and self-help groups didn't go and didn't talk about political awareness. They started with something not simple, but something that that was really important for the women. So in many of the communities in Andhra Pradesh, the women that these programs are reaching are what we call Dalits or untouchables. And what they said, what was most important for them initially, was to be able to walk through the village with their heads held high. Now, that could have really been very, very confrontational. And so they did that collectively. And as women started walking, you know, with their heads held high through the village and then started doing these small, basically, credit activities, there hasn't been a confrontation with the large landlords in any of these places. I think it's also probably because the government was behind this, so that it wasn't an NGO that was coming in and doing this work, but people realized that it had government backing. Seva, on the other hand, by definition is a trade union and has brought about change by taking their case to the High Court as well as to the Supreme Court. So by nature, it's been confrontational. And I think because of that, they have probably been less successful. Not to say that the laws that they brought about changes in were not important, but I think combined with the confrontation combined with the dispersion of the number of activities has led to diffusion of their resources and probably less scaling up in terms of just economic clout than the other programs. I think one of the other things that's been important in these programs is not assuming that someone, a political elite in a village, is by definition an enemy. So they've built alliances where they've been feasible, and the women themselves are very articulate. In fact, in one of the villages I went, I asked them about political participation and alliances with different political parties. And they said something that I thought was brilliant. They've started standing up for elections, and I said, which party? And they smiled and they said, we are putting up candidates from both parties for each seat. And they said the reason is very simple. Whichever party wins, or it doesn't matter for us, we will win. Because they are offending people from both sides. In this particular case, they said the village pradhan or the chief, they were also going to put up a candidate for the village panchayat, the leader. And the village leaders came and asked them not to. And they said, okay, because the person that they were fielded was the husband of one of the women who was part of the movement. So women themselves take much more nuanced positions than outsiders can possibly figure out, because it's all based on these very complex local political realities. On culture, you're absolutely right. The framework downplays it, but in fact, it's sort of subsumed under social. We could include it separately, but I'm wary of long lists. But if you look at the text, it's very much in there in terms of particularly capacity to aspire. But your point is absolutely valid. What else? Role of social capital in the Philippines, reducing poverty in the Philippines. I don't know enough about Philippines to be explicit to make say anything useful. I do think it's important to differentiate between social capital. I think in the early days it was all right to talk about social capital, but I think the nature of social capital, what type of social capital is important. Let me just give you an example. Very simply, we now talk at least about three forms: bonding social capital, which is when poor people get together or within the organizations of people who are similar, which helps people cope but doesn't help them move out of poverty because everyone has limited resources. bridging social capital, which is social capital, which is making, having ties with people who are unlike yourself, so that it can be on in wealth, it can be on gender, or on any ground, so that your pool of resources or expertise grows. And linking would be more vertical, which is linking either with government, civil society, it could even be patron-client relations, which again, you have access to different resources. Now, I think the third generation, first generation was social capital, second generation was these three forms. I think the third generation will be looking at the different impact of these three forms in different cultural and social contexts. So if societies are stratified, these three forms may have different importance than in more homogeneous societies or communities. I think I've covered most of those questions.
I think that we should draw this to a close, because it's been, I know, a long day for Deepa and for many of you. So thank you for your questions, for your interest, and for coming tonight, and especially thank you to Deepa Narayan for a fascinating and stimulating presentation.
Thank you very much.